Hello and welcome to the Vorthos cast. I'm Lorelei Weissel-Labrizzi.
And I'm Chris Delano.
And we're here with what is kind of a unique bonus episode. We are breaking our weekly release schedule. And because this week we have an interview with first-time Magic author Isaac Fellman, who wrote the No-Tell side story about Yuma and the baby cactus whose name I'm conveniently forgetting right at this moment when I should really remember it. Kiri?
Kiri, yeah.
Is that it? And a friend from back home. First of all, Isaac, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much.
And thanks for agreeing to join us here. People loved this story, first of all. Second, for folks who may not be familiar with your other professional work, talk about some of the fun stuff you've done before working on Magic.
Oh, sure. So I have two lives. I'm a novelist. I wrote a novel about an archivist who's also a vampire called Dead Collections, and a mountain climbing fantasy called The Breath of the Sun, and a very, very bleak, dark academia novella called The Two Doctors Gorski, which is just sort of about, like, I don't know, like, ostensibly it has fantasy elements, but mostly it's just about grad school. Like, grad school itself is a fantasy element. Like, it's a bad scene on the whole.
Yeah. So, I was going to say, dark academia, that, so you just mean academia.
Just, literally, it's just regular academia. So I am also, as you would expect from the fairly esoteric subject of the first book I mentioned, also an archivist. So I work with historical documents and like historic diaries and correspondence and just all of that good stuff.
Is there like a specific sector of archivism that you do, or like, well, what kind of archivist work is it, if you can talk about it?
Oh yeah, I work in an LGBTQ community archives called the GLBT Historical Society. We're in San Francisco, and we mainly collect the queer history of San Francisco, the Bay Area more broadly. But we really tell the story of our city as a microcosm of the story of the nation. I think that's how it often works with queer history. Everybody has their local version of the news. And I, among other collections that come to mind, I'm responsible for caring for the diaries of Lou Sullivan, who was a very important figure in transmasculine history. He kept this like 30-year, very beautiful, very horny diary about his life and loves.
Good for him.
Yeah.
That sounds rad as hell.
So good. Yeah. Sorry to interrupt. Yeah, it is.
That is actually like a really, really cool job. And I see a new name writing Magic Story, and I looked you up and I saw your books, and I've definitely seen them on shelves before at like bookstores, and I've been curious about them. But now I really want to check out especially Dead Collections, because a vampire archivist sounds really fun.
Yeah, it's got like this great cover by Evangeline Gallagher. It's just this very it looks like exactly what it is, which is a thing that you can't say of every book. It looks like a big pink cobweb. And I think that is kind of the vibe of the story.
Excellent. A question we like to ask all the authors that we interview for the first time is what was your connection to Magic? What did you know about it, however much or however little, before you got hired for this project? Seeing like what people knew before they worked on Magic and what they learned working on it is always kind of a fun little journey, I think.
With some trepidation, I will answer virtually nothing. It was really, like, they emailed my agent, and I thought about it, and I just sort of thought I would need to be really honest about my lack of background in this. I think I could find a way into it. And just the main thing is, like, this is something that you don't say no to. Like, it's like one of the great nerd canons, and like to have my name on it. Yeah. It's just the idea spoke to me, even if like I'm just not a deck building game guy. Like it's a language mm-hmm. that I don't speak. But of course, you know, no one has asked me to design cards or to think about game mechanics. So this is my wheelhouse. In all honesty, it also has a lot to do with the fact that I'm a massive like Mountain Goats fan. And John Darnielle is like not secretive or subtle about his passion for Magic the Gathering. So it was extra cool for that reason. I was like, oh, God, John could say this.
I love that so much as another massive Mountain Goats fan.
Yeah.
To think that John Darnielle brought a Magic author, like brought someone to writing Magic story through posting about his awful decks on social media.
I always had the sense they were awful. I couldn't tell, but the tone.
They're great. They're honestly beautiful works of art. I'll say that.
John playing Magic, he is living his best life, except when he's living his worst life, when he'll be very vocal about when things aren't going well. I think he posts about Magic as much as he posts about like literally everything else in his life combined. It's phenomenal.
Yeah.
He's a wonderful person. One of my partners actually got to like VIP access to a Mountain Goats concert here in Philadelphia a couple years back. Cause Mountain Goats were in town and there was also a tournament nearby. And so John just like showed up to play Magic and that partner works as a judge, a tournament judge. And so like got chatting with John. John was like, hey, you want to come see the concert tonight? And so my partner was like, hell yeah.
Yeah.
John's great. What a wonderful individual.
Also, yeah. Technically a Magic author because he wrote flavor text for that secret layer. So you are in the same wheelhouse as John Darnielle when it comes to writing Magic story, sort of.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. So what was that experience like coming and working on an IP that you didn't have a lot of context with? How was it to like delve into the world of Magic?
You know, I sort of laid out parameters for myself when I set out to do this because like I've always been sort of obsessed with tie-in fiction and with the kind of like vast collaborative writing process, like writing, like being in a television writer's room, that mm-hmm. kind of thing, where are you collaborating? You are not only collaborating with people who you know, but also like people you haven't met yet, people who are long gone, people who have literally died. You are all mm-hmm. sort of like in this together. And I really liked the sound of the creative challenge of doing something like that, where you would only be like a little tiny piece. And also, like as a person who has been reading like fiction that's tied to IP rather, not advanced placement, the other thing, from way back, I was thinking a lot about, because I'm very easily annoyed. And so I thought about like what bothers me that I would like to avoid? And I sort of concluded that it's just a matter of walking the line between putting too much of yourself into it and therefore ignoring the canon, or putting mm-hmm. too little of yourself into it and just sort of treating it like as a potboiler. Like you mm-hmm. want to go like down the middle way where there is something of you here.
Yeah.
And like, I always think about like, you know, like the patron saint of coming into a canon from the complete outside and nailing it is like Nick Meyer writing Star Trek: The Wrath of Khan, where he was not familiar with the canon at all. He just found an episode that he really vibed with and then was like, I'm going to add Sherlock Holmes to this, essentially. And it
for
worked.
Real? That's
a little bit
crazy.
Yeah, no, it's like he watched a few. Don't quote me on this. Like, it's been a while since I've read like Star Trek stuff, but I believe he watched a few episodes and like Space Seed was the one that he latched onto, and I think he actually did, because one of his main things was that he was like a professional Sherlock Holmes like fanfic writer for a bit there. Like he had a novel called mm-hmm. The 7% Solution. I think I'm getting the number right. But like the main thing is like as a fan, like an extended professional fan writer. Yeah, I shouldn't be using the A word, actually. Like we shouldn't regard fan writing and professional writing as on a spectrum with each other in that sense. But like he really just sort of enjoyed adding. This is a long tangent and we can cut it. I am just throwing that.
No, this is phenomenal. This is the content I'm
cutting any of this.
Okay, fair. Like he would he just added like his particular flavor of like optimistic bad vibes, where mm-hmm. the characters are really going through it. He loves to put characters through like really like a lot of emotional pain and having to confront the things that they've done. And also like he really emphasizes the deep connections that they have. And so that worked really well as a new voice in Star Trek. And so I thought, you know, like Nick Meyer and I, very different men, but that's the person I want to be, you know, like mm-hmm. lighting my little candle to as I think about mm-hmm. how to do something like that.
Yeah. That's very interesting. So a thing you don't know about me, because we're just meeting. I have been doing some freelance work for Magic for about 6 years, writing card names and flavor text, and then some video game VL. But I've been a Magic fan for a lot of my life. So the perspective of coming in and already being highly invested and coming into an IP and having to find the place where those fit is very different. But the walking the line between yourself and the IP is something I feel very deeply. Like, except like from the other end of it, of I have so many thoughts about the IP that like I have to make sure to make room for myself, or I'll crowd myself out of it as like an author in terms of like voice and tone and theme and stuff. So it's very interesting to hear you talk about kind of the mirror of that process coming from the other direction and finding that balance that way. Writing for IP is hard.
It's so hard. It was every bit as interesting as I thought it would be.
I love hearing that. And I love, well, I guess, this question is a better segue into the thought I just had. How much of Yuma as a character in his story existed before you were hired onto this project? So like how much of this story was stuff that was given to you, and how much of it was stuff you brought to Wizards? Kind of where was the starting point of that balancing act?
Really, absolutely nothing of him existed before.
Excellent.
Before I got the email. Yeah, I got like a few sentence long brief. This is actually I was thinking about this as I walked home from work today. Like, he had a different name.
Yeah.
So yeah, they renamed the character after I finished my work on the story, and I was really surprised to find when it was released that his name was Yuma. And like, I was just thinking, like, does it count as dead naming someone if you are calling them by like their working title? And if like he has never been real. So like, I'm hoping that I don't let an Adrian slip out, because like that's a little bit who he still is in my head. But yeah, they just sort of told me, come up with, you know, like roll up a character for me. And mm-hmm. Like, he's from a place called New Capenna, and he is mm-hmm. running from his past. His past is now caught up with him in the form of his creditors. He needs to defend the place where he is now from the dangerous gang that has been chasing him. And that really has, there are a lot of doors that can open off of that couple of sentences. Mm-hmm. And like, really what I just did, TV Tropes was my best friend. Like, mm-hmm. I have also been like a compulsive TV Tropes reader from way back, and it was just mm-hmm. really helpful to sort of see, to get the overview. What are the factions? But like, how do the factions feel? Like, TV Tropes is really, it's not great, I think, a lot of the time at interpreting fiction. I mean, I'm only saying this because I always disagree with its interpretations. Like, good is a very relative thing, but it is really good at conveying what the experience is. Like, it'll do the Matrix thing. You can download the feeling of a canon into your brain. Mm-hmm. And I got attached to the Riveteers right away. I thought, these are definitely my people. I want to write about somebody who like was quite politically committed to what the Riveteers like used to stand for, and who is like part of a splinter group. I can work with the story of idealism and not really, you know, is it idealism that you then fail, or is it idealism that you then outgrow because your understanding of things becomes more nuanced? I think that the mm-hmm. two characters in this story would answer that in totally different ways. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he really did come straight out of the brief, in short. I saw him in my head, and I knew what I could do.
I will say it is incredibly normal for characters to have their names changed right yeah. before publishing. So,
oh no, it's like I was super down for this, to be clear. You know, like, I do not mind. It is not like I didn't name him the first time. Why should I name him the second time? But it reminds mm-hmm. me of, you know, like, you don't really get final say about your cover or your title a lot of the time, writing yeah. prose, like writing original prose.
As a person who often is one of responsible for naming these characters or renaming these characters, I also have the same problem. As I spend all these months knowing this character by this one name, or knowing this character by these seven different names, and then they only get one at the end of the process, and I'm never going to remember it. That's great to hear that you latched onto the Riveteers. They are also my favorite faction of New Capenna. I wrote for the New Capenna set a couple years ago. I also wrote for Thunder Junction. I love, and you talk about failing idealism or outgrowing it. And one of the things I really liked in that you did in the story that, like, really embodies at the core of what New Capenna is talking about the Riveteers as, hey, we're the union man standing up for workers' mm-hmm. rights, but also now this dragon lady in charge of us is having us do crimes, and the power's going to her head. And what if actually this thing that we were so attached to isn't the idealism that we thought it was going to be? How do we move away from that? How do we continue to embody the things that we learned from that? And that kind of balance between idealism and power is, like, really at the center of New Capenna as a world, and these, like, yeah. five crime families, and the era that it's pulling from. And I think you nailed that vibe so well.
Oh, I'm so glad. Like, just sort of coming in, like hacking my way in through the wall rather than the door as I did, it really means mm-hmm. a lot to hear that.
That is the Riveteers way, so.
and it's they, like, oh, man. This is something that I've just been replaying Disco Elysium, and I've been thinking uh-huh. about.
That makes sense.
Like, just right. The sort of the union politics in that game, and like the way that it really, really focuses on how, like, all systems and groups of people sort of inevitably drift from what they were trying to be. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting to sort of look at. You know, just sort of like the unexpected flowers that come from that root.
Yeah. And like, you know, this gets mirrored in this little found family of queer minority survivors struggling in a cutthroat capitalist hellscape city. Extremely relatable. but literally the talk of this group once they leave the Riveteers, and then the breakdowns that happen is as a transgender person in Philadelphia in a capitalist hellscape city. I know every single person the story is about. I have met these people in real life. The dynamics, the personalities, the rationalizing, it just feels so grounded and real. And I loved it so much. Like, eerie to be reading magic story that could have happened in my own life. You know, besides all the magic that happens also.
yeah.
But like the context of your archivist work really makes me understand how you got to this point. in this story, and hearing a lot of the fun and follies of these people. It ruled.
I really appreciate that. You're saying that it's because I have known so many variants of this kind of story too, and you know, mm-hmm. and also just the ways that like people from your past will unexpectedly show up. Like it really is like he was part of sort of a tiny little scene, and then he moved to a new city, but it turns out that like the people in your old life, you know, they don't cease to exist. They keep feeling a way about you, and they grow in different directions than you. And I just, it can be really shattering when you have to talk again. And it's funny. I know that some of the like reactions to this story, like I saw like, you know, a few trans people saying, you know, like this is something I really recognize in some immediate ways. And I remember sort of thinking, I actually didn't think of it as an especially trans story. I thought that the fact that Yuma is trans is something that certainly comes up in the story. And the fact that Elnor has like an accepting but slightly weird vibe about it, mm-hmm. you know, like that was an important part of it for me. The fact yeah. that, you know, she is understanding of him, but feels that this is something that he now owes her for. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when people were saying, you know, like I see throughout, like I recognize like tropes of like trans masculine anxiety in here. I started to, well, I remembered the thing that I always remember, which is you tell on yourself so much more than you think you're doing whenever you write something.
Fucking yeah. true.
I wanted to ask if you knew going into the story. So magic has a really long history of fiction. It wasn't until like, I was about to say 5 years ago, but also like time has been moving, so it's been closer to 10 years ago. Then magic got its first canonical trans character in Alesha, Who Smiles at Death, which is a trans woman. She's incredible. Very, very popular, famous story came out about her. And then it was a very long time before magic had more like trans and non-binary characters. We've had quite a few at this point, not enough, but several. But Yuma is magic's first named trans man in all of its canon. Did you know that going in, or did you just write a trans guy and that was the character?
I was definitely told in the brief that they would like him to be a trans guy. I suppose I thought that he might be a bit of a first, but I didn't necessarily want to ask because I felt on some level that if it was a yes, the pressure would feel really huge. Mm-hmm. So I just chose to write it my way and not really think about that.
Smart. That's so much smarter than me. I had a project writing our first non-binary human planeswalker a couple years ago that Lordy, I had a lot of anxiety attacks about it.
Yeah.
Don't do that to yourself. That's very intelligent.
You made me do like my Mozart laugh, or at least like one syllable of it. It's
right.
I'm saying this because it's a laugh of recognition. Like I sort of figured out from like bitter experience not to put too much of a political expectation on my writing. Because it's just, you know, it causes you a lot of pain and it doesn't cause anybody else a lot of pleasure.
I found that the reception to Yuma was incredibly positive, especially among the trans mask players of Magic, who finally have a character that they can point at and go, hey, look, I'm in the game. I'm there. And so it's been very nice to see that in Magic, and especially with such a cool character. Yuma is just one of my favorite characters we've had in like a side story for Magic for a very long time. He's incredibly like, he just fits the genre so well. And I just love him for that. The sort of like tired, weary with a past barkeep who, you know, has a real softness to him, but also you're like, ooh, if I ever got in a fight with him, he'd probably take me out. And I really like that about the character.
What, like on a date?
Well, I mean, if he's looking, but I think, you know, he's got a kid. It's kind of, I don't know if I'm ready for that commitment. I was curious, like, this story is like, you know, they're from New Capenna, but this is quite a Western feel to it. It's got like the bar fight, a lot of the language. Are you like a fan of the Western genre at all? Are you familiar with it? Or what other influences did you pull into writing this?
I would definitely like to talk about this. I want to step back before I answer that question and just say, Lorelei, I hope that my saying that thing about like causing oneself pain and not causing others pleasure, that was in no way like a personal read. I'm afraid I haven't read your work, so I didn't mean to like insult. Like,
oh no, you're good.
Yeah.
No, I learned a lot of lessons during that project. That was big personal growth. 3 months for me. So
that's so real. It's like I often and then I often find myself like when I finished a project, I realized then how much I've learned from it. Again, it's just I don't know what it is about writers. Like a lot of the time, we're people who. Are not tremendously self-aware because we project all of our feelings into fictional people, but then we read what we said later, and again, we're like, oh, well, that's what I'm like. Oh, dear.
And it was a fascinating project for me because at the time I was working on that project, my personal gender journey, I was like, I'm a trans woman. And since that project has been out, I'm like, oh boy, our listeners about to hear how complicated my gender is. I don't use man or woman, and I don't use non-binary as a label because I don't like using non-binary as a label because that often gets shunted into third gender space and used as a kind of antithesis to reinforce a binary.
Yeah, and no, that's very well put. Yeah,
that's not a judgment of anyone who does use non-binary as a label because we all make our own choices. But for me personally, no, my gender begins and ends with the word dyke, and I like to keep it that way. So it was very interesting to me, like working on for the Magic fans is the Nico Iris script for Arena. To be working on this project and being like, wow, I'm a trans woman. Do I really have like the authority to be writing this script in a respectful, which is a stupid, stupid way to think because this is the games industry and the other option is probably a cishet dude writing it. And that's just worse. It was a big lesson learned time. I know the things I did wrong and put in a lot of mental processes to keep myself from ever getting to that point again.
It's always so interesting also. Like I remember I have more or less landed on trans man as my as what feels like my conclusive identity. I do find that the more I look at gender and especially my own, you know, sort of like the more amorphous things feel, you find yourself really breaking it down and thinking, well, you know, like what is gender? I don't know anymore. I have thought about it so much that I no longer know. I only kind of know how I feel and what I am. But I also did like a lot of writing about ways that I would come to identify and think, you know, do I have the right to be in this room? And then later sort of realized, oh yeah, well, that wasn't the right question. I am finally going to answer the question about like genre influences and interests. I'm not really a fan of the Western. I love the imagery. Like I have definitely read like a fair amount of fiction and seen like a fair amount of films like set like broadly in the American West through history. But Yeah, no, the way I came at this was through noir. Actually, I just
great.
I knew that I couldn't, like, I just think that so much of writing well, I am still figuring this out, of course, like every single day that I sit down to write something, but you've just got to find the angle on something that you're trying to do that you know something about. And once you can just sort of like figure out like where, you know, like, I don't know if I'm talking about angles, I guess I'm talking about sculpting. So let's say that you found like the place where you want to ship that piece of marble, like then everything kind of comes together. But sorry, there was a siren in the background. I was pausing for a moment. It all comes together. But yeah, like for me, I knew that was not going to be Westerns. I don't know enough about them. So, but I am like a really big fan of noir film and hard-boiled fiction. And the thing about writing hard-boiled fiction is that like it's a genre where there was very much like there is a greatest ever to do it, who is universally agreed upon, in my opinion, and that's Raymond Chandler. And I have always sort of like stopped myself from trying to write a hard-boiled narrator, because literally what's the point of doing it if you're inevitably going to do it worse than Raymond Chandler did? But there was just something about doing something that was like mixed with another genre entirely that was just sort of this like chimera of literary forms that just made me feel like, well, you know, like I'm not competing with Raymond Chandler in this arena. This is not something that I think he could possibly have imagined anybody would ever do. And so that really gave me the freedom to, you know, start writing a story where like a dame walks into the bar in the first paragraph. And that was really, it was so satisfying. It was just like sinking into like a hot bath. I was like, yes, this is where I've always belonged. The other thing is I was thinking like a little bit about the vibes of like the kind of noir movie where the main character is on the run from their past. And, like, I wasn't thinking about this while I was writing, but I was thinking, you know, today, how would I answer this question? And I was going to cite a really great noir called Dark Passage with Humphrey Bogart. And Dark Passage has ridiculous amounts of trans resonance. It's like it's off the chart. Again, this didn't occur to me until today, because like Bogart is on the run from the law. And the first half of the movie is told in the first person. You never see his face. So it looks like a first person shooter, or like the kind of RPG where where it is told in the first person. And then in the second half, like he has plastic surgery and to get a new face. And then you finally see him. Now he looks like Humphrey Bogart. We don't know what he looked like before. And so there's like a real gonzo spirit to like some of this moment in filmmaking where like they, you know, you couldn't afford I don't know how they would have imagined like the effects before CGI to make the same actor look like a different person. Like you could do elaborate prosthetics. You could use a different actor with a similar physique, but why do that when you can just do something weird? And so, I was thinking a little bit, this is my moment to do something weird.
Real quick, what was the name of this film?
Dark Passage.
Dark Passage. All right.
Yeah.
I'm gonna have to go watch it. My background is in film. I also, noir is a genre I like that I haven't seen nearly enough of. Humphrey Bogart is great, and I just want to see what the year is on this. 47.
Phenomenal. Yeah, that sounds
phenomenal,
right.
Yeah. Time period for noir.
What an era, you know, like this was dropping, like The Third Man was dropping. Like, I don't, like, just a few years after the genre was invented, like it was already like just nonstop. Yeah.
There were a lot of repressed emotions in American society post-World War II. So, yeah.
God, that's the thing, right? It's like all of these. Oh, God, what is that? What is that amazing noir about? No, it's not with me. It's got such a generic name. It's about a glowing suitcase that kills you. And like, it's the most like, okay. I need to Google this before I move on with my life, even though we're way off topic.
That sounds like such a new Capenna story.
I 100% think that it is. Oh, yeah, I'm thinking of Kiss Me Deadly, which is a little bit later than I thought. 55.
Okay.
But yeah, it's got like a great like dirtbag detective who like specializes in handling divorce cases where he provides the infidelity himself. And
this is 55.
Yes.
No, I need it. This is so much more interesting that it's the 50s and not the 40s. Holy shit.
Yeah, it's like great. The Hays Code is cracking all over. Like the main character is like running through the ruins of the Hays Code as they go.
You know, I definitely, you can definitely see the noir influence in No Tells, which is very interesting because New Capenna is sort of like the noir setting for Magic. Or
it's our roaring 20s setting.
But yeah, I was like, oh, a cowboy noir. This is what I have to do. This is what I'm fated to do.
Raymond Chandler definitely would never have given someone a dragon gun. So that's definitely not in Raymond Chandler's wheelhouse.
I've got that advantage over him. I will always have the dragon gun.
Which is just such a fun little like dragon demon thing. That was such
Well, they told me this was so neat because they told me like one of our hard and fast rules is that there's no guns in Magic the Gathering. And so like if you want a ranged weapon, you have to come up with something else. And we also talked about the thunder mechanic that's so important to this setting. So, you know, like I came up on. Like, I didn't even really come up with the Thunder Crossbow. Like, that was in the guide, but I did really like, you know, like the long-suffering gun being with the bad boss.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, now that you say that you came at this from a noir angle, that feels like glue that is holding so many pieces of the story together. But also, I think works really well as a backdoor into Westerns. Especially for a revenge plot like this. You know, this is something that the Western genre and noir are kind of ships passing in the night about. Mm-hmm. But also coming from New Capenna is also just kind of like another angle to that noir is hitting like the correct vibes at. That is a very cool way to kind of to feel your way around this kind of narrative space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that was what I was curious about when I was asking if you were like a fan of the Western genre, as if you were coming at this from the point of view of a Western that is also a noir, or if this was a noir that was also a Western. I definitely got the vibes that both of those were associated here, because this is still like the old saloon with the what is it Jay always says, the lone wolf and cub dynamic of Yuma and Kiri with the like, you know,
because it's a dynamic that's rooted in the lone wolf and cub story.
Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, not something I'm super familiar with personally, but I know that Jay definitely brings it up all the time, especially when we're talking about Mandalorian.
That's because Mandalorian also pulls in that exact same trope space. A lot of things have. It's common and popular, and it's a good vibe.
The Mandalorian did it so well. Like, it was really, I really had to stare at the ceiling a lot to think about like how not to make this too much just me trying to do the Mandalorian. It's like also like this. I need to say. My editor on this project, the best note that I've ever been given or probably ever will be given after my first draft of my outline was, it's great, but you have to put a cactus in. I was like, okay. I hadn't seen the art. So I didn't know that he has a cactus friend.
That's incredible. We don't know a lot about the cactus people at the moment. Not a lot of that has been made public. We know that they're really thorny and really interesting. I definitely found Kiri very interesting in the story. I loved the way that I forget if Kiri uses what pronouns are used for Kiri in the story. But
I think Kiri's a he, him. But I don't know if that's just something that you was projecting, though.
Yeah, it's a cactus. Their cactus. We're not really super sure about what's going on there.
What does gender mean if you're a cactus, you know?
It's one of those questions where it's like I don't know.
Don't you're going to make me think about plant genetics, and that's not a place I want my brain to go, because plants are really messed up.
Yeah, but I definitely loved Kiri. I thought Kiri was very cute, very interesting. I loved the finale of Kiri, like, just turning this little area into like a little oasis of cactus life. It felt like washing away the past, but also honoring it at the same time, because it's coming from Kiri, which I loved. And, you know, I love that part of the story.
Yeah,
it's funny you just had to add a cactus.
Yeah. And it was really, I mean, of course, obviously, like, now the cactus is the beating cactus heart of the whole thing. And it's I can't imagine it without the cactus. And yeah, it's I am also thanking you, because that bit was like, that ending was really hard to come up with. I was trying to like, I really wanted it to feel like closure for the story and thematic resonance, but it was so hard not to just make Twi. Like, it was so hard not to just make it a transparent metaphor for a new life as a completely positive thing. And, you know, like now everything is wonderful and we are blooming. That's something that could play really well visually, but as with a character describing it, it has a different weight. So, yeah, I really had to think about how to make it a little bit uncomfortable to think about. And you're just thinking about, like, the effect that it has on the humidity in the room, the ways that it intertwines with the building and just kind of like replaces the roof that it used to have. And it makes it a place that I feel like maybe is very welcoming, but not necessarily very comfortable to be in the same way that it used to be, because you no longer know what kind of place you're in.
Mm-hmm. I think that is a really good metaphor for Thunder Junction as a whole. It's not the same place you've been, but it's welcoming. But it might be a little difficult. Now I thought that was just an incredible way to pull the whole story together, especially since, like, you have these two characters. Well, one of them is just trying to kill the other one, or is she trying to kill Yuma? It's kind of like, does she want to kill him, or does she want to just scare him? It's sort of the question in the air for the whole story.
Yeah.
And then to have them at the end able to just sort of walk away from each other, to have gotten everything out in that fight and just move on with their lives. And I don't think that would have been possible if it hadn't been for Kiri making the whole place real weird.
Yes.
You know, putting them in a whole different sort of situation.
Sometimes the story just needs a weird baby in it.
It does. It simply needs a weird baby with strange powers. Like, yeah. That is genuinely one of the... Oh, there's that, like, famous line that Chandler has, I think. No, it's definitely him, where he is... Unless it's apocryphal, but it seems like something he would say, and it was certainly in line with how he wrote, where if you can't think of where to go next, you know, like, have a man walk in the door with a gun. And but I just think you could say the same thing about have a baby with strange powers exercise their strange powers.
Yeah. So this is something I was curious about. Of course, not knowing... your future, anything you might be working on, all that stuff, you know. But like, if you were writing another story for Yuma and Kiri, where would you want to take them from here? Like, a lot of Yuma's past has just sort of been resolved. He's free now in Thunder Junction. Where would they go? Where would you want to take them?
I thought this was a really interesting question. When you emailed it, I thought about it a little bit and I wrote some notes. Because one of the things that I really like about Yuma is that he's a homebody. He's a very indoors person. He just wants a home. And a lot of what upsets him in the story is having his home destroyed. And then the resolution is realizing that he needs to redefine it again. He's sort of positioned as an NPC in the story. Like, you are watching him in the first person as he tells you this story after you've come to, like, new location, new setting in the game. And so I thought about a few things, but ultimately I decided, like, what I really want to do is just, like, an old-fashioned casino heist, because I like the idea of getting him out of his comfort zone again, because, like, I do, like many writers, really love to torment my characters.
Good.
But also, this is another thing he can do under a roof, and in like the kind of setting that he thrives in. Like he can set up house in a way in like sort of like a larger, you know, like corrupt casino with like a bunch of interesting figures in it. He can just kind of like burrow his way in, learn the rules, and then begin to exploit them. And so like I would also like, I just think it would be cute to put like Kiri in like a little tuxedo. Like the costuming possibilities are like they really abound. And like I don't know if I would also introduce like a few more characters who could be collaborating with them, or if it's just the two of them working together. I don't know why they would be doing it, but yeah, I would want to keep it an indoorsy story and one that is reliant upon just what I said, figuring out what the rules of something are in order to make them your own, not necessarily even to break them, but to make them your own. And that's gender. Yeah, sorry, but it is though.
I was gonna say that's gender, and the whole discussion of what does it mean to make something your own and what does it mean to break it, what are the differences between those things, is also gender. So yeah, no, I'm on board.
Yeah, I said I would tell on myself a lot. I've told on myself with every single thing that I've said so far in this podcast.
No, I love that idea. It also fits really well with the wider themes of the Thunder Junction story. I don't know how familiar you are, but the main story of this set is about a big heist. Not a casino heist.
Oh my God,
it's a big heist. Yeah, it's actually a ragtag group of people getting together to rob a big vault. So you've got the vibes. You found them.
Good. I'm glad that I've located the vibes. I was so worried about working on this. It was the main thing I was worried about because, like as a person who, like writes fiction professionally, and who is also like, I have written a bunch of fanfic in my time. I have been a fan of a lot of things. And like I said, I am super easily annoyed, and I just wanted to give people who know and love this setting what they want. I don't necessarily know what people want in terms of like this, the feeling of the story or the plot of the story, but I know what it is like to want to be in conversation with another writer or like another creator. Like gameplay is a creative act. I will defend that case. I will defend that argument. And there's nothing worse than having someone present something to you that you think like, wow, we are total aliens to each other. So I'm glad that I got the vibe correct. That was my goal.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, you talk about the pressure of writing for IP, and you know, Magic at this point is a 30-year-old IP, but this is actually the debut of Thunder Junction as a world and Yuma as a character. So there are kind of ways where yes, you're writing for a 30-year-old IP, but also you are on the leading edge of exploration of some new things within that IP space. You are in fact writing a story that is helping define things for the future, in some ways, which I don't know if you were aware of when you signed on to this project.
A little bit. I mean, I knew that the setting was new. I knew that the character was new. I certainly didn't really think of. I was thinking about all the people who I was collaborating with. From the past, but I'm not even really sure I was thinking about the ones in the future who are collaborating with me. Like also often without by knowing them. It's really cool to think about. This is just really cool to think about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a really interesting world Magic story because of the fact it is a 30-year-old IP, but also in the sense that a lot of authors of the last even just like 5 or 6 years are often building off of each other, referencing each other, incorporating things that have been written by other authors. It really is like a giant collaborative story writing family in a lot of ways. And I don't mean that as like, oh, we all get together for potlucks, but like in the family sense of like a family tree or like a you know,
yeah,
there are traits being borrowed from each other. With Thunder Junction, there was a character created two sets ago who just showed up in the story. And it was like, this character probably wouldn't have shown up if it wasn't for the fact that the author who wrote that character initially made that character so lovable that everyone was like, we need her back in the story, like bring her back. And yeah. So like, that's part of it, is like authors sort of, you know, feeding each other characters, feeding each other characteristics, even of how these people behave, paving new ground for other authors to walk on.
In a real sense. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I completely interrupted you. I was just going to say, in a real sense, you are literally creating a culture, you know, like you are. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You are participating in a big role play with each other where you are creating a culture of a new world. And that's very cool.
Yeah. Calling it a big role play is, I think, actually very correct.
Yeah.
A lot of it is authors sort of just taking a character and being like, this is how this character is going to be. And then other authors having to go and build off of that and create something great and beautiful. And one of the reasons I love Magic Story is the fact that there's a lot of hands in the pot. And a lot of, you can see the influence on each one of those characters and each world that people have written for. And I love that personally. That's what I enjoy about it, is that you can see a little bit of every author in every story.
Yeah, I mean this kind of harkens back to our talks about balance between author and IP. One of the things I really like, both as a fan of Magic and as someone who now creates content for it, is and just one of the things that I like about IP in general is getting to see where those boundary lines get chosen in a bunch of different circumstances for different people. Where is, so like, say you have 10 authors in the future, I guess 9 additional authors to make the numbers easier, to write Yuma in the future. None of these 10 people who have written Yuma in this theoretical scenario will write the character the same way. But because it's IP work, things about the character, you know, are, everyone has kind of a responsibility to make something about the character coherent through mm-hmm. the feature. And being able to see which pieces of the character get pulled out because an author is bringing this part of themselves to it. Getting to see different parts of characters emphasized, de-emphasized, written about in slightly different ways, getting to see what is consistent. Getting to see what authors definitely found something resonant in a previous author's work, and pulling from that, like that, getting to watch that kind of whole creative ecosystem function is fascinating to me, and it's always fascinating for me to be in the midst of it. I am, as someone who is like, I love deep cuts. Any IP thing that I get interested in, I want to find the stuff that like nobody knows about, nobody talks about, and fall in love with it. I love esoterica. Magic is no different. And so like, I will have moments where I'm like making a reference to a thing published 25 years ago that nobody but me cares about. And it's just like the transcend, like you can feel the weight of that time. And like, it's a really unique feeling to be like part of this whole process.
In the same way that you can feel the weight of human time, you know, it's just, it's really exciting to actually think about the way that a process like this, you know, this happened like over the course of like, I don't know. I guess if it's 30 years old, I was 10-ish when it started, but you can reach back into like your whole life and sort of think of this project mm-hmm. as something that occupies a human lifetime. Like not, mm-hmm. I don't mean to be excessively utopian, but I'm into it. What was the other thing I was going to say? You said some really resonant stuff just now. Oh, it's gone. It's gone like tears in rain. Oh, well.
Thanks. Blade Runner is one of my favorite movies.
I mean, speaking of noirs, I need to rewatch Blade Runner. I haven't seen it in 15 years.
I wrote my undergrad thesis about it. And yeah. Constructions of humanity through technology and phenomenological explorations of such things in the way that whole film just embodies tactility and memory and eye motifs, and it's good.
Yeah.
It was a good paper. And fun.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm really overtired today. I had a thought, but it was gone again.
We're at the point in the podcast where our thoughts are just leaking out of our head. It's fine.
Oh, yeah. just kind of like the thoughts were once solid, now they are liquid. Yeah, that's
transgender
very real.
Of them.
Wow, I'm really doing like all of my entire repertoire of laughs throughout this recording process. Like we heard like sort of my deep manly laugh, we heard my Mozart laugh, we heard my titter. That's how you know it's actually going well.
I'm glad you think this is going well. This is great. I'm having a phenomenal time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love having authors on. It's like my favorite thing we do. But we are getting close to our hour point. Typically, we reserve the last couple minutes to talk about our final thoughts, which is just whatever we're thinking about. Could be anything related to magic or just our lives, the world, movies, whatever. I do want to give you a chance, Isaac, before we sign off, to plug anything. If you've got something you want people to know about that you're writing or that came out, if you want to plug your books again, whatever you want to, you know, take this opportunity to advertise to our listeners.
Sure. In addition, I mentioned my books at the start of this, but I suppose I will just quickly say their names again. Dead Collections, The Breath of the Sun, and The Two Doctors Gorski. I also have a novel coming out in still about a year, which is called Notes from a Regicide, which is sort of a trans family saga of art and failed revolution is the tagline that I find myself saying. It's got a lot of stuff going on. It's happening in three different genres at once. And I'm really moving further into that. It's a feel good bummer sort of space with it. I really love a story where everything's going badly and everybody feels bad, but they're also in their weird way having a good time.
That's so real.
Right. Like they are finding ways, goddammit. And I'm really excited about that one. It's my favorite thing that I've written a couple things since then that haven't sold yet, but definitely up to the point when I read it, when I wrote it, it was my favorite thing I'd ever done. And so I'm very proud of it. Those are my plugs.
Awesome. We'll definitely, when it gets closer to publication date and you can share more information about it, we will make sure our listeners know, because, you know, I'm sure a lot of people who really loved Yuma are going to want to go out and read some more of your writing. But other than that, our final thoughts, Lorelai, do you have a final thought you want to share real quick?
Usually I have a whole week of my life between episodes to think of new final thoughts. I got nothing.
Yeah, I don't really have a lot other than magic story good. I really liked, as of recording this, we finally have the finale of Outlaws of Thunder Junction, and things were really, really exciting there at the end. That's just my thought.
Yeah. My thought is that I might actually be a bit utopian after all, despite myself. I feel like this conversation has really brought home for me just why working on this was creatively satisfying and why I actually, you know, if anybody listening to this, ever gets the call, heed the call, accept it. Do not refuse the call.
That's a good final thought.
Yeah.
For you future magic story writers out there, heed the call.
Yeah, no, I almost didn't do it. I thought I am not up to this. I am too much of an outsider to it. And I'm just so glad, literally just for my own sake, I'm really glad that I did it. It was so weird and so interesting. And I love to see the backs of things. I love to learn about, like, they sent me the guide for writers and artists, and I got to sort of see, like, the ways that they started imagining all of these forms that everything was going to take. And it was so like the part of me that just wants to read about how they made Star Trek also wanted to read about this.
They tell you not to think too hard about how the sausage is made, but sometimes how the sausage is made is fascinating.
Yeah. Counterpoint. Yes.
Oh boy, I just set myself up for a really awkward segue into our finale. If you also would like to see how the Vorthos Cast sausage is made, you can head over to patreon.com/thevorthoscast and support our show today. Everyone who does gets access to our Discord community, where we have Vorthoses from around the world talking about Magic Story, enjoying Outlaws of Thunder Junction preview season. We still have two epilogue stories to drop at some point, I assume, after this episode goes live. Again, we're asynchronous to our user schedule, so I don't know how everything's gonna fold out. But we got good, exciting, big, fun things happening. We love our little community of fans here. This episode with Isaac, thank you again so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
This was very fun and interesting chatting with you. For all the folks out there listening, thank you all for listening. This has been the Vorthos Cast.